Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have a question to start off today's show. It's for my esteemed co-host and our super producer. My name's Ben. Noel, did you ever play sports as a kid?
Yeah, I was not very good at it. I was in the outfield in baseball, and I think I played soccer for like a couple of months or something like that. Mm-hmm. I was a very sluggish child and have grown into a very sluggish adult.
Don't be too hard on yourself. What about our super producer, Casey Pegram? Casey, did you play any sports as a wee tyke?
I was a perpetual left fielder in baseball. If anything was hit in my direction, I was not catching it.
Right.
And if I was at bat, the only way I was getting on base was if I got walked.
Right.
But once I was on base, I was pretty good at running.
Yeah.
But, you know, other than that, no.
Totally. Just getting on the base.
Yeah, that's the thing. That was the rub.
And maybe that's why in this country it's so popular to refer to stages of intimacy as different bases on a field.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm still confused. I think everybody has a different opinion about what third base is, or as we said when I was growing up, what shortstop? You know, I was always interested in that.
Well, but then, you know, some people refer to the act of lovemaking as scoring.
Right.
That's true.
Right. At least Beavis and Butthead did.
Conception sometimes can be getting one past the goalie.
That's right.
So there's all kinds of sports metaphors.
Or sliding into home.
Right. And we always think of baseball as the national pastime in the U.S. And that's why there are so many metaphors or figures of speech and idioms that refer to the sport of baseball. But this wasn't always the case. In today's episode, we're looking at another strange craze. It was not as long lived as baseball, but in its heyday, it was as popular. And that, my friends, is the sport known as competitive walking.
Sounds like the laziest sport ever of all time. The dullest as well.
It sounds like a Tim and Eric sketch.
Right.
You know?
It's like professional paint watching.
Right there with you. It's strange because it was also a spectator sport. According to Matthew Algio in his book, Pedestrianism, in the decades after the Civil War, from the 1870s to the 1880s, millions of people were moving into the city, and there wasn't much for them to do in their free time. So pedestrianism, competitive walking matches, became really popular. They were a social event for people to go to. They were a sport for people to watch. And when we first found out about this, it reminded me of trying to do that not quite run, not quite walk that a lot of kids do in elementary school. Like you're in a library and you're chasing someone or you're running down the hall and a teacher shows up. So you still kind of, you're skittering, but you're trying not to move your body as though you're running. That's what a lot of this stuff looked like.
Atlas Obscura reported in an article called "The Hot 19th Century Sport That Launched Modern Sports Betting," pedestrianism actually got its start in the English aristocracy. As we know, servants, or at least a particular flavor of servant, were known as footmen, and that was largely because their job was to carry things on foot. And, you know, as the super rich are sometimes wont to do, they turned it into a cruel game wherein they pitted footmen against each other for their own amusement, and it became a hot betting situation.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, a lot of the emphasis for this sport was going to be on the endurance of the participants. And it was always, as you said, I'm glad you raised this point, it was always sort of this rich person's game. They would consider themselves sportsmen, but they were really just sending their servants in as their proxies and betting on them. When we go to the U.S., what we see is three things had changed post-Civil War. The nation was industrializing. People had more spare time than they did in agrarian economies. They also had a little more disposable income.
And infrastructure.
And infrastructure, exactly. And the country overall had recovered from or fallen from this stern work ethic, this antebellum work ethic. And now people said, you know, it's okay to unwind. I want to have a little fun. I got a spare couple of sawbucks or whatever. So let's go watch the competitive walk. And it had some advantages over other sports. First, it needed no special equipment. The people were the equipment. And second, it didn't really cost much to set it up. You didn't have to make a purpose-built field or anything like that. And wouldn't you know it, by the 1870s, the nation was awash in what the Chicago Tribune called walking fever. And even newspapers that covered it were a little bit confused by it, right?
This reminds me of like a Mr. Show sketch or something. It's like Coupon the Movie, you know? It's like, America's got walking fever. You know, it's like the dullest sounding type of fever that America could ever possibly catch.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I say they were confused is because papers of the note would say stuff like, well, let's take the Chicago Tribune example, which we found via Mental Floss. The Chicago Tribune said, walking is at best not an absorbably entrancing sport. But according to Mental Floss, the Tribune was neglecting a very specific fact. People have more free time, which meant that a large segment of the population was bored. People were desperate for entertainment. Not everybody had easily accessible droves of knowledge the way that we have with cell phones.
Right, and even like catching a play or like a concert or something outside of, you know, a home situation would have been available but too expensive to do like on the regular. You know, it'd be a special occasion for sure.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yeah. So a ticket to a theatrical show, to a play in Chicago at the time would cost you $1. And that was about twice the price of a ticket to a week-long world-class walking match.
They really were bored, weren't they?
These people were walking in circles, by the way, in this particular match.
Of course they were.
The Mental Floss article that just mentioned, also written by Matthew Algio, the author of Pedestrianism, has the headline, "The Insane 6-Day 500-Mile Race That Riveted America." That's right. 6 days, 500 miles. They were walking in a circle. It reminds me of questions people have asked me about racing before when they say, you know, why do people watch things like NASCAR?
Right. At least with NASCAR, they're going quite fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more, there's a lot of potential for fiery crashes. The stakes are a lot higher.
Yeah, I think that's part of why people watch it.
I do appreciate Algio's characterization. He is giving this much more credit than I think it deserves and really tries to really sex up this whole walking idea. He's describing the countdown that would have led to the beginning of this race. One, two, on three, they were off with hips swiveling and arms pumping. The great walking match for the championship of the world had begun.
Mm-hmm.
Hips swiveling and arms pumping. So this implies that they're power walking then.
Right, and power walking or race walking, as it's called officially, is an Olympic sport today. And it's more than worth watching a couple of clips on YouTube if you'd like a chuckle. Now, I'm not saying these people are serious athletes. I'm saying that when you're outside of the world, of their world, that type of walking looks odd. So we know that in this endurance match, the 600 miles in 6 days, we know, thanks to Algio's research, a little bit about the day-to-day of the race. The racers were on the track continuously. They'd have these cots set up inside the track, and they could nap maybe 3 hours a day. But other than that, for about 21 hours a day, they were power walking around this track. And the rules were simple. They would just map out a dirt track on the floor of an arena. A lot of these matches took place at the first Madison Square Garden in New York, and the lap was about a seventh or an eighth of a mile. You could only walk. The only reason, by the way, that this was 6 days was because at the time, public amusements were banned on Sundays. Otherwise, it probably would have went longer, 7 days at least. So they started right after midnight, 12:01 Sunday night, Monday morning. And that's when they had that countdown that you were talking about, Noel. And then they just kept walking until midnight the next Saturday.
Wait, what about pee breaks?
They took pee breaks and, you know, like I just said, they had the cots where they slept for 3 hours a day.
But they have like porta potties, rudimentary like outhouses?
They had to, yeah. They weren't horses. They didn't just go while they were walking.
You didn't think they maybe wore special, you know, absorbent pants or something? I don't know.
I don't believe so. There is one thing. The pedestrians, those were the participants in these, did drink a lot. Not necessarily a lot of water. They drank a lot of champagne during the race.
What?
It was considered a stimulant.
Really?
Their trainers told them to drink champagne because they were under the impression for some reason that this would give them an advantage. The problem was that a lot of these dudes would just slug it by the bottle.
Seriously.
So that's not a stimulant. That's the opposite.
No, and wouldn't it get you kind of dehydrated if you were just drinking lots of alcohol and sweating and not drinking water?
Right, right. I guess it depends on how fast you're walking.
And what time of year would this have been?
November.
Right. So a little chilly.
Yeah, it's getting there, especially if we're talking Northeast, right? And New York in November, it's not exactly sweltering. Also, I want to say that this was a big social event. People weren't just in silence holding their, you know, their betting tokens. There were brass bands that were playing songs. There were people selling snacks that were popular at the time, like roasted chestnuts and pickled eggs. I think the latter is gross, but that's just me.
You ever had a roasted chestnut?
I have, yeah. I've made roasted chestnuts.
I've never had one, but they always make them in New York around the holidays on the little, you know, the street carts, the food carts,
yeah.
And they really smell good.
They're great. Mm-hmm. I would say also you should be able to get some year-round at H Mart, at least chestnuts.
Okay. So how do you roast them? You just put them in, like, on a sheet pan and, like, put them in the oven with a little olive oil?
I'll send you the thing.
Please do.
Yeah. So this was also a seen and be seen kind of gathering.
Oh, but there were a lot of big hats.
Mm-hmm. Future president Chester Arthur, not Chestnut Arthur, but Chester Arthur was at this one. James Blaine, a senator from Maine, was a big fan of pedestrianism.
James Blaine, a senator from Maine?
Yes.
I love that.
I'm leaning into the sketch comedy aspect of this. So sometimes people in the crowd would be there to see the famous spectators as much as they were to actually be at the power walk.
Yeah, so it's kind of like golf.
Yeah, very much so.
And a lot of standing around, because they were going in a fixed track situation.
Yep.
So they would be in stands, I would imagine, like bandstands, where you would kind of see. How long was a lap, did it say?
It's a seventh or an eighth of a mile.
Okay, so it wouldn't take a whole heck of a long time for them to get back around.
Nope.
So you'd be, but it would take you a long time to track the progress of your person.
They had people assigned, right, to watch each person.
I guess so. I just wonder, like, with the whole sleeping cot situation, how would they keep track? Like, would it be, like, you know, like, in terms of, like, who was ahead?
Yeah, they would keep a clock and they would add your total times. But also, because this started as a sport that was centered on gambling, there were multiple ways for the gamblers, the true players here, to win. You could gamble on who was going to be the first person to drop out or who would be the first person to achieve a given number of miles.
Got it.
So you could go any number of directions with this. There were so many ways you could gamble. Also, and this comes to us from the NPR statements, also the pedestrians themselves were not necessarily wealthy people. So it was pretty easy to rig the odds too.
You could
pay someone to drop out first,
take a dive, as it were. And it also, that kind of goes hand in hand back to the roots of the sport, with the aristocrats being the ones, you know, watching for their own amusement and potentially, you know, prospering, and then the lower classes being the one that actually had to do the work.
That's a great segue to talking about the people who are actually doing the work. Because like any other sport, this sport had its LeBrons, you know, it had its Larry Bird's. It's what are some Andre Agassi, Pele? I'm just naming.
Pele was a soccer guy.
Yeah, I'm just naming different sports.
Andre Agassi is tennis.
Yeah.
Yeah, my favorite tennis star name, it was from when I was a kid growing up in Germany, was Boris Becker.
That's not bad. I've never heard of him.
Yeah, he was big in like when I was a child.
Okay. And he was an adult tennis player, right?
He was an adult tennis player,
so
yes.
Like your shady past as a child tennis player.
I was a child tennis prodigy, actually.
Well, you were a prodigy.
I gave it up, though. I gave it up for outfield.
Oh, yeah.
For being an outfield turd.
Yeah, which is a conversion of almost religious proportions.
Really?
So competitive walking is no different. They have these icons at the time. Noel, could you tell us a little bit about the guy who was like the protagonist, the main character of competitive walking?
Oh, you mean Edward Payson Weston?
The very same.
The household name?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Edward Payson Weston was absurdly famous. Because again, we have to remember, the nation had walking fever. And, you know, it was hot. As ridiculous as it sounds, and he was bringing the heat in the 19th century. He was originally a bookseller, a door-to-door salesman of books. He lived in Providence, Rhode Island, and then in 1860, he and a friend made a gentlemanly wager on the outcome of the election. And he actually bet against Abraham Lincoln and lost in spectacular form. And his punishment was that he had to walk from Boston, Massachusetts, to Washington, D.C. in 10 days. Wow. That is a crazy bet.
Mm-hmm. He really thought Lincoln was going to lose, obviously.
Guess so. Yeah. Wow, yeah. And he had to go see the inauguration in person. And it became kind of almost like a... I don't know how the media caught wind of it or if he made a big deal about it, but whatever the circumstances were, it became kind of a media blitz.
It went, as we would say today, viral, because this was walking in the Northeast in the middle of winter. The roads were not that great. And all along the way, people who had heard about the story would come watch him, you know. Many of them, no doubt, expect him to fail or falter, but he made it in time. And then after the Civil War, he was still famous, and he said, you know what, it's worked so well, I'm just going to keep doing it.
Right, but instead of being the dead of winter, walking in horrible conditions, you know, alone, he did it in front of crowds, indoors, you know, where they would go to, like, roller skating rinks or different places like that, community centers, and walk, like, 100 miles or something like that, like, in a day. Mm-hmm. And people would, again, I can't get over how bored people must have been to find this, you know, hey, look at that guy, really, look at his gait, look at his form, like, that guy really got a walk to him. Yeah, they would watch him walk around in circles like all day, and they'd pay, you know, a dime or something to see this happen. I guess it was also like, you know, it brought people out. So people, sure. You know, that was part of the entertainment too. I don't imagine everyone was just eyes on him, you know, for a day.
Yeah, it was more like, let's do something different. Let's get some culture. Also, he became a national symbol in some ways of classism. He was like a figure skater in that he would dress in very garish, flashy outfits. And he was, I guess for another sports analogy, he was like the Yankees or the Patriots, because people knew that he would often win these things. And as you said, sometimes he would just hold exhibitions, and people would see him not necessarily competing against someone. They would just pay to watch him walk in a circle. I mean, that's good work if you can get it. And we, for Pete's sake, are podcasters. So he also made his name when he walked. At one point, he walked 1,200 miles from Maine to Chicago, Portland, Maine, in under a month. And he won $10,000, in $1867, in the process. So people thought he resembled old money, old America. And we know how these kind of competitive sports work. So, of course, he had a rival.
A nemesis who represented the working class.
Right.
You know, the blue collar and immigrants. He was an Irish immigrant from County Cork, Ireland, who had come to the States about 10 years prior to the walking craze being a thing. And he had no money, no job, and just was a scrappy kind of personality and found his way into this kind of upstart pastime.
Right, and he was no slouch of his own. He had walked 116 miles in under 24 hours. He was very much seen as the upstart, the working man's hero. The public was going gaga for the hype about these two having a match. He also represented hope for Chicago's Irish community because his last name was O'Leary. And, you know, in the 1800s, of course, Catherine O'Leary, no relation, had been blamed for being responsible for the Great Fire of 1871. You know, she's the one, Mrs. O'Leary's cow, who allegedly knocked over a lantern. So she was a scapegoat, and this kind of discrimination against her bled out into the rest of the city's Irish immigrant population. So Dan O'Leary was seen as like the Irish hope. It was proving that Irish people in Chicago weren't all bad. This is why Algio calls them Weston and O'Leary, the Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier of their generation. Weston's flashy. He's moneyed. He wears capes when he walks, which I think has some chutzpah. He is more, I would say, the businessman of the two because he understands if you entertain people, you can make as much money off the entertainment as you can off the athleticism, whereas Dan O'Leary is much more on the athletic side.
He's no frills.
Right, right. You get what you get.
He's in it to walk.
Yeah. It's about the walking for
him. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Did you mention that dude also carried a cane?
And Weston.
Likely, I just imagine him wearing a monocle.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and a top hat and a cane and a cape and really, really thought pretty highly of himself, it would seem.
Yep.
He was the cock of the walk, as they say, huh?
There we go.
Okay.
Or the cane of the lane.
There you go. Yeah, he definitely tried to stay in his lane. You know,
cape of the scrape, this cape of the pave. They're not all going to work.
No.
So this becomes in many ways an analog for cultural tensions that are brewing. Don't feel too bad for O'Leary because over the course of his career as a pedestrian, he made the equivalent of $1 million or so just walking. Again, cannot emphasize this enough, in circles. Now, at this point, you may be saying, Casey, Noel, Ben, this sounds like a heck of a time, but why can't I pay to watch people walk in circles nowadays? Why is the only thing left to me, you know, stumbling around at Chelsea Market and watching people who patently do not know how to walk? Well, we have an answer for you. America's craze, the walking craze, faced some stiff competition in the 1880s, primarily because of something that emerged called the safety bicycle. Unlike earlier models of the bicycle, like the penny farthing and so on, the safety bicycle
had patently unsafe.
Which were patently unsafe. The safety bicycle had two similar size wheels.
Crazy.
Who'd have thunk it?
Right.
I feel like that's the one you should have thought of.
Who came up with the big wheel in front and the tiny wheel in back? It makes absolutely no sense. You're riding up so high.
Yeah.
I guess innovation happens in, you know, spurts or whatever, but sure. Like it just seemed like it would have been a no-brainer to have two wheels the same size.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing how a car works, you know? Like it's like half a car.
Right. And the penny farthings, I'm trying to think of a more articulate way to say this. They sucked.
Yeah.
They were just terrible. They had vacuum. But the safety bicycle was nimble. It was faster. They were more interesting to watch when they were in a race. It was cooler to see people on a bicycle racing or on bicycles racing than it was to see people just sort of walking around, even if they did have capes. Also, this is the thing. If somebody messes up in a bicycle race, it's a way better crash.
Right. Back to the NASCAR thing. Yeah. Faster, more potential for havoc, you know, more potential for Schadenfreude.
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff that makes a good spectator sport.
Hey,
Did we mention that a lot of these big walking matches took place at the original Madison Square Garden?
That's the first one, yeah.
Yeah, that's how big this this craze was. But all good things are incredibly weird and dull things must come to an end. And, you know, the bicycle racing combined with a few other factors really put a nail in the coffin of America's pastime, the walking craze. And one of them was what we talked about at the top of the show, baseball.
Yeah. The National League had been founded in 1876. It became a profitable business when the team owners reorganized. People who once had watched walking matches now wanted to watch baseball. And this meant by around the middle of the 1890s, pedestrianism was on its way down. It was being beset with charges of race fixing, of corruption that had been there since the beginning, and doping.
Ooh,
right?
Performance enhancing drugs.
No way. Not from a place where participants guzzled champagne.
Right, exactly. And I'm guessing, you know, you just needed something that would give you a little more pep, a little more zip in your step. And that would have been like chewing coca leaves.
Yeah, that's how Weston went down. That's his Armstrong moment.
Exactly. They certainly wouldn't have had anything like the modern doping techniques that we see today with steroids and the like, or, you know, human growth hormones or whatever. They just had the good old chewing a coca leaf. And if I'm not mistaken, chewing a coca leaf would be a stimulant buzz equivalent to doing cocaine.
I could see that, because people did consider it unsportsmanlike when Weston was caught chewing coca leaves. I think at the time it wasn't illegal. I guess it's illegal to chew those today. I guess it's like doing cocaine.
It would be tantamount to possession of a controlled substance.
Okay, I see. And Weston, when he was caught, said his doctor told him to do it. But people said, you know, this is a bad sign. Have you guys heard of baseball? Let's go watch that. These six-day races are a little more like freak shows than they are like feats of athletic prowess. So this all culminated in the extinction, the downfall of competitive walking and pedestrianism in the 1890s. But make no mistake, folks, pedestrianism created a legacy that remains today. One of the biggest legacies it's left us with is the idea of corporate sponsorship.
I was hoping yeah. We were going to get to
that.
We
didn't even talk about that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So Dan O'Leary, the working man's hero, was a spokesman for a brand of salt. A guy named John Hughes was sponsored by the National Police Gazette. That was a newspaper at the time. And he raced with a shirt that had the paper's logo on it because, you know, his body is the race car in this sort of deal.
My Little League baseball team was sponsored by a local plumbing company.
Cool. Do you remember their name?
Nope. Just remember they were... That was plumbing.
Let's see. We had some different corporate sponsors. I think a lot of little league places are like that. I was in a team that was sponsored by the Church of Starry Wisdom.
I thought you were going to say the Church of Satan. That would have been cool.
Oh, the Church of Starry Wisdom is a whole different. Well, it's not that different. It's a good reference.
Is this a cult? I've never heard of this. It sounds cool.
Google it and check it out later. But don't reveal it on air. We want to keep that reference for folks who already caught it. So these guys also were immortalized on some of the first precursors to baseball cards, cigarette trading cards. Back in the 1800s, you buy a pack of cigarettes and you might get a trading card with one of your favorite athletes. And one of your favorite athletes might have been someone like Dan O'Leary. So one thing we do have to say, too, these pedestrians, you know, it's easy for us to crack on them a little bit and say, walking, how hard is that? But if you're familiar with the Richard Bachman story, The Running Man, and the fantastic film adaptation thereof starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, then you know that walking for a long period can be some real exercise. And those pedestrians put modern running backs to shame. During a football game that might last, you know, 3+ hours, players only really run about 1.25 miles, much less than the pedestrians of the 1800s. Also, Running Man, huh? Do you guys remember that film?
Yeah.
I still don't understand why that one guy sang opera.
Did he?
Didn't he?
I don't remember.
I feel like one of the plants.
They're like gladiators almost.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I just wanted to take a second to plug the career of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who I believe is the protagonist in the film adaptation of The Running Man, right?
Absolutely. Let's see. I'm trying to get a list of the different gladiators in the. Gosh, one of them is Jesse the Body Ventura.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Unless I'm mistaken, hang on. We've got Buzzsaw, who kills the runners with his chainsaw and even cuts hard metal. Okay, that's helpful. This is from a wiki, fandom wiki. We've got Dynamo. He's the gladiator. He's played by Erlen van Lith, who uses electricity.
I believe that's the opera guy.
He does look very operatic. He's got like a Ride of the Valkyries kind of outfit on.
And Jesse Ventura is Captain Freedom.
He is in it. Cool. Yeah. I was just making that up. Then we got Fireball, whose power, surprise, surprise, he shoots fireballs.
Oh.
And then we've got my favorite, who really just looks like an embarrassing hockey player. He's like goalie. He's got all this padding on, and his name is Sub-Zero. And he's got a sharp stick and a hockey puck that has explosives.
I think it was Dynamo who had a little kind of go-kart thing.
Got it. And right you are, Captain Freedom, baby.
Mm-hmm.
He is a he's described here as a pensioned gladiator. He is the best. I think this is a British site. I think it means he's like the
retired.
He's retired, or he's a veteran.
Gladiator emeritus, perhaps, yes, if indeed. He's pensioned.
Oh, by the way, he kills people with his bare hands. He doesn't need a weapon.
No, he considers that unsportsmanlike. That's not what Captain Freedom's about. So let's go back to Weston and O'Leary, because you may have noticed, folks, we didn't tell you what happened to them. So, Noel, what happened to Weston O'Leary after pedestrianism was no longer the national craze?
Well, you know, you can take the pensioned Walksman out of the walking race, but you can't take the walking race out of the pensioned Walksman.
You got there.
Yeah. Whew, that made me sweat a little bit. So, you know, he kept on walking. He was 73 years old. He walked from New York to Minneapolis. And he, it's a little sad actually, on route would sell 10-cent souvenir programs. But I don't think he had didn't have the following that he once did. I think he was largely just kind of selling them sort of like a Hare Krishna at an airport, you know?
Yeah, and O'Leary decided that he would hitch his walking wagon to the rising craze of baseball. He became a baseball pedestrian, self-described. He would stage walking exhibitions before games in ballparks around the U.S., and then he would sometimes challenge one of the players on a team to run around the bases twice while he walked around them once. And he often won, which was good PR for them. And then this is another sad part. After he did all that, he would walk through the stands, literally with his hat in his hand, getting nickels and dimes to take care of him so he could have money to live off of during the off seasons when he would spend time in California.
You know, I actually think this could be at the very least an episode of television or something. You know, I would love to see this as a short film, perhaps.
Yeah, I would watch it. I would watch it as a full length kind of League of Their Own thing.
Yeah, but it's also like it's the end of an era, and you had someone who kind of rose to the top of this very odd fad, this kind of flash in the pan thing that then gets replaced by something almost overnight that has a lot more staying power, and to like be, you know, established as like the leader in your field, and then your field just starts to disappear.
Yeah.
And you have to scrap for nickels and dimes and, you know, challenge the people who literally replaced you to foot races. You know, it's a sad kind of feeling. You know, you really do. Again, it reminds me of a Mr. Show sketch where they're talking about Megaphone, like the Masters of Megaphone tour.
Has like counterfeit money machine, sports bra.
But the whole idea is that these guys are Megaphone crooners.
Yes.
And then something came along and replaced Megaphone crooning, and the people were all Megaphoned out.
I don't want to lose the thread, though, with O'Leary, because he is an interesting contrast. He wasn't caught doping.
Right. Well, it makes sense.
Yeah, and he gave health advice based on walking, and he would say, people would ask him for exercise, suggestions, especially for people who are too physically weak or impaired to play baseball or more demanding sport. And he would say, do not take strolls. Vigorous breathing is what builds up a healthy life. So he wanted you to walk like a machine, walk like him. And he lived well into his 80s. And people who saw him said, even when he was old, he still walked that way, ramrod straight, and no cocoa leaves. You had, Casey, off air, you had said that there's something about cocoa leaves that might be of interest to
Yeah,
them.
So it's not equivalent to actually doing cocaine if you chew a cocoa leaf, but it is a mild stimulant. This is coming from an Associated Press article. Suppresses hunger, thirst, pain, and fatigue, and it's also used to mask altitude sickness. So in Bolivia, for instance, you know, the people who live like up in the mountains are, you know, fond of chewing it just to kind of keep their energy up. This became kind of a political issue because Evo Morales, previous president of Bolivia, was very much in favor of legalizing coca leaves and allowing farmers to grow them and chew them and so on. And the United States was not in favor of that. And you see how that all ended.
Casey on the case. And speaking of endings, I believe we have reached one. We should also say that there were many other people who broke through. We're focusing on O'Leary and Weston, but we would be remiss if we did not shout out Frank Hart, an immigrant from Haiti who entered a six-day race in Boston and performed so well that he moved up to the quote-unquote major leagues of pedestrianism. And he was taking part in what was, he was a breakout in what was largely considered a white-dominated sport. This sport also opened doors for other men and women of color. We saw people like Ada Anderson, who proved that pedestrianism could help women achieve new status levels as well. And Frank Hart, by the way, once he won a prestigious race in 1880, headlines published his name from coast to coast. And this was at a time when, because of the color of their skin, people weren't afforded full citizenship. So pedestrianism, in a very real way, helped break down some of the disgusting barriers of race that existed in this country, which is weird because before we did this episode, had any of us heard of pedestrianism other than like people walking on sidewalks?
No, and I think we're going to get to this in a later episode. But when I think of pedestrian, I think of the time when the auto industry essentially wanted to malign pedestrians by inventing the abusive term jaywalkers.
That's correct. I did an episode of Car Stuff about it a few years back, but no one listened to that because we're doing it on this show.
We're totally doing it. And pedestrian itself as a word usually means something's very humdrum and run-of-the-mill and kind of basic.
Right, like vanilla ice cream is the pedestrian choice of ice cream. But you know what is absolutely not pedestrian? The eggnog that we are about to crack open, made by our good pal Alex Williams. Thank you so much, Alex, for composing this track and for making some eggnog for us based on the recipe of one George Washington.
It's true. I can't wait to sip that nog. As always, big thanks to Casey, super producer Casey Pegram, our research associate Gabe, Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit.
Thanks to, of course, Eves Jeffcoat, our colleague who has her own history podcast, popular in This Day in History class. And, of course, thank you, pedestrians the world over. We've all been pedestrians at some point or another. And, of course, thanks to you, Noel.
Right back at you, Ben. See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.